Resuming my full soul focus reflection series on how ideas about the soul affect personal and cultural well-being, a reminder that you can always access recordings of prior installments on the UUCPA website if you like. And to very briefly recap the first three introductory talks, I described how while the modern era has given humanity immense gifts, its dominant philosophy of materialism, which holds that physical matter constitutes the whole of reality, has also purged any transcendent or transrational, that is, beyond the rational aspect from human life. And though suicidal despair and authoritarian domination may seem poles apart, I suggested both arise mainly from the resultant spiritual wasteland, what world religion scholar Houston Smith terms an abnormal condition for the human spirit. And their archaic religious remedies now only aggravate these and related ills. Then, drawing on Plato, I offered a very different transrational template that the rest of this reflection series will unfold. The main points are that human beings have a soul and enter the world with a life blueprint and a personal calling slash destiny. Plato also describes the soul's spirit companion, termed daimon in Greek, D-A-I-M-O-N, and genius in Latin, that guides the soul during its earthly excursion. And that people identifying and living out this calling as wholeheartedly as possible is personally beneficial and potentially culturally transformative. Then last week, I broadly described the historical emergence of materialism's anti-social worldview. Per that in this week's title, that's anti-soul-shul. And just touched on some of its harmful psycho-spiritual and societal consequences. I expand on those today and will say more in April after we pause for other services in March. Cultural historian and philosopher Richard Tarnas was one of those who described the astoundingly swift and powerful rise of modern materialism, which emerged from the Copernican Revolution, he calls a stupendous event which destroyed an entire world and constituted a new one, and resulted in what he terms a tremendously magnified confidence in human reason. And continuing now, this had definite benefits, gradually dispelling the prior world's fixed social and economic constraints and providing an unprecedented sense of individuality and self-determination. Yet with this, reports German-American sociologist, psychologist, and philosopher Eric Fromm, quote, people had lost something, the security and feeling of belonging which the medieval social structure had offered. And since that structure was as much spiritual and cosmological as physical and social, the inner at-homeness most people felt evaporated like protective amniotic fluid off a newborn's skin. So while more liberated, says Fromm, they were also more alone. And they includes us. Because among the other myriad gifts of science, today we know that the developing universe is mind-blowingly immense and in ways breathtakingly beautiful. Yet while at times this may induce considerable aesthetic appreciation and wonder, materialism considers it, in Tarnas' words, a spiritually empty vastness, indifferent to human concerns, governed by random processes devoid of purpose or meaning. Nobel laureate physicist Steven Weinberg pithily summed up this intrinsic meaninglessness. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. Hence, Tarnas can justly conclude, thus did the Copernican Revolution establish the essential matrix for the modern worldview in all its disenchanting ramifications. The most celebrated of human intellectual achievements, it remains the watershed of human alienation, the epical symbol of humanity's cosmic estrangement. Since that fundamental dislocation, perceptive thinkers and artists have steadily revealed this deep and abiding contradiction and incoherence. As Fromm puts it, side by side with their emphasis on human dignity, individuality, and strength, they exhibited insecurity and despair. One of these was Tolstoy, who, although venerated, famous, and prosperous, found this existential situation, quote, impossible, and considered suicide, recalling and paraphrasing Sharif Abdullah from my first talk, a radical opting out of a worldview that doesn't work, a viable option. And so, like the teen suicide and other bleak statistics I also shared then, we're back to despair. Because as Richard Tarnas states simply yet profoundly, the soul knows no home in the modern cosmos. In this cosmos, the term event horizon denotes the outer border of black holes, beyond which not even light can escape. By jettisoning the soul, materialism has created a spiritual prevent horizon, a perceptual perimeter from which no transcendent illumination can issue. No wonder things are dim. Archetypal psychologist James Hillman underscores this in observing that science's cosmologies say nothing about the soul, and so they say nothing to the soul. And he advises, wisely in my view, that explanation by the physical sciences of the ultimate origins of and reasons for our life, or likelier, I'll insert, the lack of any reason, may not be such a good way to go. Any cosmology that begins on the wrong foot will not only produce lame accounts, it will lame our love of existence. Having created this abnormal condition of mythic dissociation, mythologist Joseph Campbell's term for when a culture's central narratives about the nature of existence fail to keep people, quote, transparent to the transcendent, materialism obviously cannot escape its own self-made black hole of the soul. Nor can the antiquated religious formulae that Joseph Campbell submits are now ineffective, misleading, and even pernicious escape their doctrinal confines. But a soul-focused viewpoint can and does. Our soul and its calling as central features of human life restores at-homeness inwardly and outwardly, that is, both psycho-spiritually and cosmologically. The latter because the more at our core means there's also more to the universe, or perhaps multiverse, than materialism allows, even if it isn't empirically distinguishable. And when that more enters a life, enters one's orbit, we are forever altered and enriched. My first talk showed this vividly with Quincy Jones, who, while committing a youthful petty crime, went from wannabe gangster to future world-renowned musician and music producer when he encountered a piano and, quote, every drop of blood in my body said, this is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And it saved my life. Mythologist Michael Mead, whose wisdom I've cited in prior talks and will again, experienced his own life-defining version. I've abridged and adapted his account and will begin some interspersed comments by stating that while what I call such destiny moments can happen earlier or later in life, the age of 13, which he speaks of, is about the same formative age that my mythically dissociated neighborhood pals and I began grasping for filaments of meaning and transcendence through our dense alcohol and pothaze days. Here is Michael Mead's story with my brief comments. On my 13th birthday, I received a book that indelibly marked my life. It was the first hardcover book I ever received that wasn't a school book or a church text. In some ways, it turned out to be both these things for me, yet also more than either of them. My closest aunt had noticed I read a lot and asked what most interested me. I told her history intrigued me, and she went looking for my birthday present. In the bookstore, she spotted a history book on an upper shelf. She was quite short, and reaching high above herself must have taken down the book next to the one she aimed at. When she gave it to me, I began removing the wrapping paper, and my aunt could see that she'd come away with the wrong book. saying it was all a mistake, she insisted on returning it. Meanwhile, I was having a completely different experience. For partially revealed behind the torn paper, I could see the image of an archer riding bareback on a winged horse. Pulling off more wrapping, I saw the archer had released an arrow at something behind him. Following the flight line led me to the book's spine, where I found a stark mask with a tangle of snakes for hair and wild eyes staring at me. Compelled by the images, I turned back to the cover to see the book, the title, Mythology by Edith Hamilton. Through an accident or an unintentional accuracy, history had become mythology, and I was instantly changed. No way would I exchange this surprising gift, not for a history book, not for any other gift either. The arrow loosed on the cover struck something deep inside me. That something being his diamond. And something leapt to the image of the flying horse and understood the language of images immediately. Like Jones touching the piano, destiny moments often include an instant affiliation and a sense of innate aptitude for the topic. In one glance, he says, I found something I was looking for without even knowing I sought it. My aunt bought the book by accident and gave it to me by mistake, what modern materialism would maintain. Or else we were both pulled into a moment of meaning. It was the right book that fell into her hand, and it fell to her in order to find its way to me. What a transparent to the transcendent soul focus affirms. Given the way my soul was inclined, continues Mead, the accident was not accidental at all. It was the kind of accurate error that occurs when fate takes a hand in things and someone's life is about to change. Unnoticed by my family, unseen by my friends, and only partly conscious to me, I had been touched by fate and found a thread of my destiny. Mead then describes the transformative effects this accurate error, the fateful nature of which we'll explore down the line, had on him. As he does, keep in mind the unnamed emptiness my friends and I, along with all the other middle-class kids tilting toward self-destruction, also felt in a pointless universe, and thus at some level a pointless life. And consider what abundance might arise for them and all sorts of folks in discovering a thread of our own destiny. Again, I insert a few comments. That night I read almost the entire book. Time stood still, and a void in my life suddenly became filled with stories and images that turned the unnamed emptiness into a newfound abundance. For me, the mythic stories offered more truth than anything I had heard or read, a way of seeing and thinking that made immediate intuitive sense of the chaos and vacancies of the world around me. I felt able to see in a new way and invited to learn what was behind the confusing foreground of life. The gift within the gift involved the opening of an inner eye that changed how I looked at life. We'll examine this inner eye later too. A radical awakening of an imagination for life that somehow was waiting to be discovered within. I felt truly pulled into the story of life and sensed I had a meaningful role to play in it. I felt in touch with something essential and artful. To be clear, while mythology entranced Mead, what's vital isn't that specific content, but recognizing whatever resonates with one's own calling and evokes this essential meaning. He continues, it wasn't that my youthful troubles went away or that I knew exactly what to do with the rest of my life. Far from it. It would be years before I could grasp what so suddenly had grasped me. To properly possess and learn to express what I'd been given. Yet for the first time, I felt not just meaningfully connected to the world, but somehow centered in myself. So both outwardly and inwardly, connecting with his soul/diamond brought him home. I felt more rooted in the world and able to aspire to a life beyond the life I had been given. I imagine there were adventures I could undertake that could take me to places of meaning and beauty. Paradoxically, yet inevitably, coming home to himself opened the wider world to him, and him to the world. I had received a true gift, something beyond anything I expected, yet something I seemed bound to encounter. This sense of the surprising yet familiar is another mark of authentic destiny moments. In the blind confines of New York City and amidst the confusions of my youth, I found something of my own purpose for being alive. For the cosmically dispossessed souls of modernity, this priceless find and all that goes with it indeed comprise the life-enhancing and sometimes life-saving gifts of a transrational soul focus. A focus that, with James Hillman, rejects materialism's contention, quote, that my strange and precious human life is the result of statistical chance, but rather respects and esteems both the mystery of one's depths and the depths of life's mystery. And when our specific soul gifts take us to places of meaning and beauty, we never journey alone. For connecting with our genuine purpose automatically extends blessings beyond ourselves. The main beauty of the gift is found in giving it, an impulse the young Michael Mead experienced. Early in the text, he says, I encountered the idea that the ancient tellers of myth transformed a world of fear into a world of beauty. I wanted to be part of such a transformation. And as an astute and charitable storyteller, teacher, and writer about myth, the soul, and society, Mead has been, for me and countless others, including homeless youth, refugees, gang members, prison inmates, and combat veterans. Yet, as I stated, it took time to develop and situate his endowment. This is true of most soul gifts, even rarefied ones, as pioneering jazz trumpeter Miles Davis confirms when he says, man, sometimes it takes you a long time to sound like yourself. Future talks will detail how to locate and nurture ours, including handling the struggles frequently involved as our soul and its diamond gradually, in Hillman's phrase, grows down into earthly life. Meanwhile, having summarized how our modern abnormal condition for the human spirit arose, after pausing several weeks for other service topics, we'll resume by exploring the very understandable reasons this condition initially became normalized, and why, despite modernism's copious benefits, its drawbacks have now become too pervasively toxic to tolerate. Namaste, and blessed be.